WHYY.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama was the commencement speaker at West Point yesterday and told the graduates that they are the first class since September 11th who most likely would not be sent to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. He also touted what he saw as foreign policy successes under his administration and something that could be called the Obama Doctrine.
America must always lead on the world stage. If we don't, no one else will. But U.S. military action cannot be the only or even primary component of our leadership in every instance. Just because we have the best hammer does not mean that every problem is a nail.
Today, we assess Obama's leadership abroad and at home and examine the possible candidates vying to succeed him in 2016. Our guests are Peter Beinart, Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at the City University of New York. He's a contributor to The Atlantic and National Journal and a Schwartz Senior Fellow at the New America Foundation. It's been a little while. Peter Beinart, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Nice to be here.
Also with us is Paul Gastrus. He's editor-in-chief of the Washington Monthly and was a special assistant and senior speechwriter to President Bill Clinton. Paul Gastrus, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for inviting me.
And Matt Lewis is with us as well. He's a senior contributor to the website The Daily Caller and a contributing editor for The Week. And Matt Lewis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Good to be here.
Matt, let me begin with you. Is there an Obama doctrine that you could describe?
Well, I tell you, the Washington Post slams the Obama Doctrine today in an editorial, which is really remarkable. And essentially, they say, based on, you know, the speech at West Point yesterday, that it's really unprecedented, somewhat arbitrary, and too restrictive, that the Obama Doctrine would not allow, for example, interventions to stop genocide. But on the other hand, the Obama Doctrine would allow intervention in Iraq, which was a multilateral campaign. And so it seems like President Obama is really being hit now for a variety of reasons, including the so-called Obama Doctrine, which did not pass the smell test with the Washington Post.
How about with you?
Look, I mean, I have to agree. I wouldn't judge him so much on any one speech where he tries to sort of lay out his foreign policy. But, you know, I'm very concerned, for example, about the drawing of the red line in Syria, which was promptly, you know, trampled over. And, you know, the sort of signal that that sends, and, you know, it's unclear whether or not that may have led to what happened in Crimea, but it certainly doesn't send a signal of strength and clarity, you know, in terms of America's resolve to our geopolitical foes.
Paul Gastrus, let me get you in on the conversation. And I'm wondering whether this president or any president in today's world needs a sort of one-size-fits-all foreign policy that can deal with things like Ukraine or Russia, as Matt Lewis was just talking about, Syria, Nigeria, China, Brazil, Al-Qaeda, Israel, Palestine, Iran. Is there a need for sort of an overarching foreign policy?
Well, I think there's a market for such a foreign policy, and I think Matt articulated that appetite. He used the word clarity and strength. That is, you know, absolutely what many Americans crave in their president. It's certainly what the Washington Post, I don't think it's all that unusual that the Washington Post would slam the Obama Doctrine. They are more interventionist and military-minded than Obama has ever been. The American public would like to have a clear, simple articulation of American policy. It is, as you pointed out, very difficult. Issues aren't, the world isn't that simple. And, you know, I was a member of the Clinton administration, and I remember before being in the Clinton administration going to editorial meetings at U.S. News and hearing our foreign policy writers and editors just slamming the administration for lacking a doctrine. I think by the end of the administration, they had one, sort of, kind of, but it was sloppy and didn't really cover everything, and I think attempts to try to do so almost always run aground on the complexities of reality. So I think what Obama laid out in the speech can be picked apart, and there are going to be examples that don't fit, but was in general a pretty good shot at articulating the essence of what he's trying to do.
And Peter Beinart, how did you see what the president said yesterday?
I think the president has a general perspective. The perspective is that under the Bush administration, America's military footprint grew far larger, but America overall grew weaker because the economic foundation of our power grew weaker and American legitimacy in the world grew weaker. And that Obama's reading of the Cold War, which I think is fundamentally different than many of his hawkish critics, was that the Cold War was a contest of economic systems and political systems, and America won not as much because of its military strength, but because of its political legitimacy and its economic strength, and that those things eroded significantly under George W. Bush. And that ending the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, which were very, very unpopular around the world and draining the United States in blood and treasure, was the important part of restoring America's foundation of strength around the world. I think where Obama has been less successful is in restoring America's international legitimacy because he's been less successful domestically in removing America more towards being a country which abides by international norms in terms of things like Guantanamo Bay. But the idea that the United States is weaker today than it was when Barack Obama took office is just nonsense. I think the United States is more favorably perceived around the world, and in fact, I think you see that America's legitimacy has grown because we've begun to move back from the two wars that hurt us so badly.
Let me go back to the president's speech at West Point and just pull out something that you just referenced there, Peter Beinart. Again, this is President Obama speaking yesterday.
By most measures, America has rarely been stronger relative to the rest of the world. Those who argue otherwise, who suggest that America is in decline or has seen its global leadership slip away, are either misreading history or engaged in partisan politics.
Matt Lewis, is the word relatively, is that the operative word in that part of the speech?
Well, I think that's the kind of thing that gets inserted by speechwriters or, you know, people who are hoping to couch declarations so that they don't come back to bite you. Look, we never know what is around the corner. When President Clinton, had 8 years of relative peace and prosperity, and, the election to succeed him wasn't about foreign policy or terrorism, and yet we had 9/11, which dramatically shifted America's priorities for the next decade at least. And so it really is unclear whether or not even the President of the United States can kind of predict what's around the corner. I would say, though, that when you look at all sorts of things that are happening, Russia with Crimea, Syria, Iran potentially going nuclear, it is a very, very dangerous world still, and I do wonder if President Obama sold this message of hope and change and this kind of quixotic notion that by the force of his rhetoric and his personality, he could make people like us again. And I think that finally, the media and a lot of the American public are no longer under that spell. And I think if you look at all sorts of scandals, including the latest VA scandal, President Obama is now under very severe political crisis right now, and I think he's kind of struggling. He's going to go to Europe next week. Let's see if he can hit the reset button again, but it's a very difficult time for him, I think.
Let me
quote. Can I jump in?
Yeah, and tell me, who is this?
This is Peter.
Peter, sorry.
I think it's important that Matt mentioned the VA scandal. Why fundamentally is our VA system cracking? It's cracking under the stress of the extraordinary and terrible rise of traumatic injuries as a result of these two wars. And so I think what we're seeing is this enormous cost of these two disastrous military interventions that were launched by the last administration, that this administration is trying, not always as successfully as I might like, to dig itself out from under. These are the costs that Barack Obama inherited, and it's precisely why I think his cautious view towards military action is well justified, given that we are still paying a tremendous price for the more reckless attitude towards military intervention that characterized his predecessor.
Let me quote something else from the speech, and Paul, I'll put this to you. Obama said yesterday, since World War II, some of our most costly mistakes came not from our restraint, but from our willingness to rush into military adventures without thinking through the consequences, without building international support and legitimacy for our action, without leveling with the American people about the sacrifices required. Tough talk often draws headlines, but war rarely conforms to slogans. I mean, he appears to either see himself or want the world to see him as a reluctant warrior.
As well he should. And let's be clear, as I can quote Obama in his own words prior to his election in 2008, that he's not against all wars, he's against dumb wars. He has shown that in his administration by surging troops in Afghanistan, by working with international partners to fight Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, by invading Pakistan in order to go get bin Laden, that he's not at all afraid to use military force judiciously and smartly when the occasion calls for it. And much of his speech was an attempt, mostly successfully, to try to distinguish between times when that force should be used and when not. But his great success as a president has been to keep America from stumbling into military engagements that we would have regretted. Again and again and again, there have been attempts to buffalo him, to get involved in, you know, moving weaponry into Ukraine or troops into Poland in order to deal with the Ukraine problem, where we now know a combination of targeted sanctions and the general reaction of international markets to Putin's moves were, so far at least, sufficient to move us off of that precipice that we were on. This is high presidential geostrategy and geopolitics practiced rather well in a messy world, and he, I think, has been a tremendously successful antidote to what Peter described as the disastrous overuse of military force and the aggressiveness and belligerence of the Bush administration that we are indeed still trying to dig out of.
Well, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, getting three opinions on President Obama's foreign policy, or Obama doctrine, if you will. We have much more to talk about after this very short break. And Peter Beinart, Associate Professor of Journalism and Political Science at the City University of New York, also a contributor to The Atlantic and National Journal. Paul Gastris, Editor-in-Chief of The Washington Monthly, was a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. And Matt Lewis, a senior contributor to the website The Daily Caller and a contributing editor for The Week. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. What do you think the Obama doctrine is? Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, the 2014 Lincoln MKX, which comes with available adaptive HID headlamps and standard heated and cooled front seats. More details about the Lincoln MKX are available at Lincoln.com.
The Pulse tells stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
This is my health. We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter.
In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia. Diagnosed.
The Pulse, Friday morning at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Nevada's former water czar shares some lessons she's learned working in one of the driest parts of the U.S. She says we all need to think more about water.
We still, in many corners of the country, take it for granted. And it's going to be one of the most challenged resources of the next century.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
this afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Join WHYY June 26th for the third annual Best of the Chefs. You vote to crown the winners at a two-hour tasting featuring an array of local restaurants and businesses. Tickets and more information at whyy.org/events.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain talking with Matt Lewis, Paul Gastris, and Peter Beinart about President Obama's leadership abroad and at home. And a little bit later, we'll be examining some of the possible candidates vying to succeed him in 2016. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Matt, I'm wondering, though, whether the president's reluctance to get involved in a number of conflicts around the world reflects how the American people feel about what the United States should be doing abroad and what our position is in the world.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of war weariness still. You see this in the Republican Party and the conservative movement, where the schism between the Rand Paul wing and maybe the Marco Rubio wing. So it's not just limited to the Democratic Party or even America in general. I mean, it's taking place within the Republican Party itself. I do think, however, when you look at President Obama's speech and the criticism that he received from a lot of places, including the Washington Post, there is a sense that he creates these straw men, that he creates these false choices between either isolationism on one hand or adventurism on the other. And I do think that a lot of Americans, at least, there's still a hunger for moral clarity, for a president who is respected in a country that is feared. And I think there is a sense that there are things that America can do to be a force for good in the world that fall short of boots on the ground, that it's not, you know, inexorable that we will automatically be drawn into a war, that there are things providing, say, moral clarity in the case of the Green Revolution in Iran, or providing weapons to, you know, Ukraine, that these are things that are not absurd and are not necessarily something that are bellicose or even dangerous, but that there are the appropriate response from the leader of the free world.
Peter, but it seems that the president is certainly a supporter of the use of drones and of special forces, with a reluctance to send in, you know, lots and lots of military people with the boots on the ground.
Yeah, I think often when we talk about foreign policy, we overly personalize it. If you look at the history of American foreign policy, presidents tend to be more influenced by the circumstances they inherit often than the ideologies they bring to office. I really suspect that a Republican taking office at this moment in time, with a country where the public is very war weary, where the military feels very, very badly overstretched, and where the country is basically flat out of money as a result of a terrible financial crisis, that those would have put very, very serious constraints on the tendencies towards military intervention of any president. Obama's foreign policy really has a lot in common in some ways with the foreign policy pursued by Richard Nixon in the 1970s. But at the end of Vietnam, it was clear that the policy of sending American troops to try to fight communism in every corner of the world was simply politically, domestically unsustainable and economically unsustainable in the United States. So what Richard Nixon turned to in Vietnam, he withdrew ground troops and he relied on air power. And he tried to fund America's allies to fend off the communists in what was called the Nixon Doctrine. Mm-hmm. I think you see similarities with Obama's policy as well. I have real problems with the drone policy, but I think the main attraction from Barack Obama's point of view is that it's relatively cheap and Americans don't die. It's a kind of return to the emphasis on air power that you saw under Richard Nixon, who was doing it for the same basic reasons, because ground troops were unsustainable. And I think I think Obama is part of a kind of series of cycles that take place in American foreign policy, which have a lot to do with how many resources we have at our disposal and how much public will there is at that moment, and often less to do with the particular ideological backgrounds of the president himself.
Paul, do you think there's something between isolationism and adventurism, as Matt was describing?
Well, I think there is, and I think Matt's point, the legitimate point Matt was making, is that Obama tends toward straw man rhetoric. Some say we should have invaded Ukraine, others not. And obviously, no one was saying, let's invade Ukraine. Even, you know, the most forward-leaning Republicans were clear that we had no good military options in Ukraine. But even in those narrower debates, as in Ukraine, the tendencies of toward a military-focused solution, in this case, John McCain calling for selling advanced weaponry, moving advanced weaponry into Ukraine, moving NATO troops into Poland and the Czech Republic. Obama didn't do that, and we'll have to see how things play out. Mm. But on the if you look at it right now, I would think the conclusion has to be he played it right, and we didn't need to be moving armed personnel carriers into the Ukraine at that moment. That was an overly aggressive, belligerent, unwise thing to have done. So, at the margins, there are people with instincts toward using multilateral cooperation, sanctions, diplomacy, backed up by vague threats of this or that, and others who sort of want to lean, want what Matt called moral clarity. And that's really where a lot of the debate is, and it was that eagerness for moral clarity that I think led us astray in the aughts in the George Bush administration, where we wound up invading countries we didn't need to invade, and not putting troops where we needed to put troops. So these discussions at the margins actually are very, 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 very important.
Well, let me quote something else, and Matt, I'll put this to you, and then we do have a bunch of callers that want to join us as well. And going back to the president's speech yesterday, he said a critical focus of this effort will be the ongoing crisis in Syria. As frustrating as it is, there are no easy answers there, no military solution that can eliminate the terrible suffering anytime soon. And then he goes on to talk about not putting troops in there, but wanting to support the Syrian people. Do you think that's an apt and a correct description of what's happening in Syria?
I think it is now. The criticism is that he just didn't act soon enough. There was a time, when there might have been some rebel forces that were, pro freedom, not terrorists who just happened to be against Assad, and that there might have been a time when we could have supported those rebels. That time has passed. I think that, we're talking about Richard Nixon earlier. I think what conservatives are at least hungry for is obviously another Ronald Reagan. And there was somebody who I think was able to have the moral clarity, but not the sort of, adventurism. And he, I think, also was wary in the post-Vietnam era, didn't want to get bogged down in any sort of, land war, but also, simultaneously did provide that moral clarity. So I think there is a sort of a middle way there that everyone's shooting for.
Go ahead.
Can I just push back on this moral clarity?
Yeah, go ahead, Peter.
Look, Ronald Reagan's basic point of view in the world was that any dictator who was on our side was great. And George W. Bush's position was basically the same thing. Under George W. Bush, America's relations with a whole host of dictators in Central Asia, in West Africa, in the Middle East, grew stronger and stronger. And I have a hard time associating phrases like moral clarity with an administration which basically decides that the United States is going to make a policy of practicing torture in black sites around the world. So I think these terms are thrown around far too casually. Where I think Matt is correct, and where I think many conservatives don't understand history very well, is that Ronald Reagan was at least as cautious in terms of sending U.S. troops into harm's way as Barack Obama is. The Republican Party, in its kind of Bush, Rubio, Cheney, Bill Kristol incarnation, is so much more militarily aggressive than Ronald Reagan would have ever imagined being. In his last year in office, some people in the Reagan administration suggested that Ronald Reagan invade Panama. Mm-hmm. Panama was not a very big country. It turned out that his vice president, George H.W. Bush, subsequently did it. Reagan said, basically, are you crazy? I'm never going to invade Panama. That would be another Vietnam. That's how we saw the prospect of invading Panama, let alone a country like Iraq or Afghanistan halfway across the world. the American foreign policy debate since Reagan has become so much more open to the use of military force than Reagan himself was, that I think in many ways many of the Republicans who call themselves Reaganites actually really don't understand Reagan's real legacy at all.
And that's Peter Beinart, who joins us along with Paul Gastrus and Matt Lewis. We are talking about foreign policy, talking about President Obama's speech yesterday at West Point and whether there is an Obama doctrine, whether there needs to be an Obama doctrine. We'll be talking a bit about some other issues as well, but let me get some callers in. We have Jerry from, looks like, Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania, joining us on Radio Times. Jerry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Morning.
I think it'd be interesting to hear the guests compare Obama's foreign policy with the first Bush's foreign policy, vis-a-vis building how Bush built a coalition before he invaded Kuwait and Iraq, and then also how he held off on using force and going, you know, through with the job, as many said, and going right into Iraq in the beginning. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
You're welcome, Jerry. Thanks for the call. Paul, do you want to take that?
Yeah, you know, when I was at U.S. News, we wrote a book based on our Kuwait War, Gulf War coverage called Victory Without Triumph, or was it Triumph Without Victory? And people felt quite confused at the end of that war, and a huge portion of the conservative movement thought Bush made a horrible mistake in not driving to Baghdad. He actually made precisely the right call, but the discomfort with not going to Baghdad so ate away at the minds of many folks in Washington that I think led directly to this huge desire that preceded 9/11, and 9/11 was used as a pretext to go finish the job in Iraq. So I think the caller makes a great point.
We have an email from Mike. Enough with the president's red line being trampled in Syria. Obama laid down the line and Assad gave up his chemical weapons. Matt Lewis, do you see it that way?
No, I don't see
it. Go ahead.
I don't see it that way. But we'll have to see how it plays out. I mean, you know, the irony, I think the real interesting part, of course, was how Vladimir Putin inserted himself into that situation as sort of the person who was going to broker peace and make sure the chemical weapons were, you know, disposed of properly. At the time, it seemed odd, but sort of now it seems especially interesting. And it looks like Obama got played, I think.
Peter, do you see that way?
How exactly did Barack Obama got played? We have 90% of the chemical weapons out of there. It's true. I never, frankly, thought that the focus on chemical weapons per se made all that much sense when Syrians were dying horribly in such a dramatic range of ways. But if you were going to focus on the question of chemical weapons, we've been more successful in terms of getting chemical weapons out of Syria than we probably would have been had we launched those military strikes. What I find kind of remarkable about the criticism of Obama and this red line on Syria is it's purely made on the argument that basically once a president sets out a red line, no matter how wise or unwise, he should go forward with it simply on the basis of American credibility. I rarely hear anyone actually explaining how sending a whole bunch of Tomahawk missiles to kill a few hundred grunt-level Syrian soldiers and some civilians would have done any good in Syria. And in fact, there's almost no evidence whatsoever that decision had any impact whatsoever
on the foreign conflict.
To suggest that Vladimir Putin was influenced in Crimea by what Barack Obama did in Syria, you have to explain why he did almost exactly the same thing in Georgia in 2008. It was entirely based on his calculation of his concern about what was happening on his border, not what Barack Obama did half a world away.
Go ahead, Matt Lewis.
Sure, I was just going to say two quick things. One, I think, regardless of the wisdom of going in or not, I mean, when a president draws a red line and it's trampled over, that president loses credibility and looks really impotent. And yes, I think it's reasonable to think that other people might be paying attention. The other thing I would bring up is hitting into Syria when they were really, you know, the Obama administration was really beating the drums of war. John Kerry basically made this out to be a huge moral crusade. He compared what Assad was doing to the Holocaust. And then to suddenly sort of let it go away, really, I think it undermines their credibility
I think that there's clear that the Obama administration made mistakes in Syria. But there's actually quite a lot of academic literature just blowing a complete hole in this idea that you hear all the time, that what one country does in one part of the world undermines its credibility such that it influences actors on the other part of the world. This is the whole rationale, frankly, for our military intervention in Vietnam. Everyone said if we give up on Vietnam, the Soviets won't take us seriously in Europe. The truth is that foreign policy actors almost always make decisions based on their analysis of the balance of forces in their part of the world and how much they think their particular conflict matters to the United States. What Vladimir Putin did had everything to do with his need to have a pro-Russian Ukraine. And there's not a single piece of evidence I've ever seen cited by anyone which suggests the Russians were influenced by what happened in Syria.
This is a fascinating back and forth. I want to throw something else into the mix here. And Paul, I will toss it to you. There are going to be more hearings on Benghazi, and this is certainly part of President Obama's foreign policy. Do you think more can be learned about what did or didn't happen at Benghazi?
I can't imagine. We've had about 9 investigations, 2 of them bipartisan, deep investigations. There's always going to be more facts that roll in over time, but 95% of what we need to know, we know. There's rarely been a quote-unquote scandal that had less scandal to it. Almost everything that's come out in all the investigations has undermined almost every argument that's been made by the Republicans, primarily, that Benghazi was, some kind of betrayal or a scandal. The larger point that I try to make in these circumstances is, you know, the United States lost 6 ambassadors to terrorism and assassination from the 1950s to 1979. It happens. It happens with some regularity. And in none of those cases did the Washington go crazy and insist that the death of an ambassador was a world historic betrayal of the honor of the United States or whatever. It only happened now. You have to ask yourself why.
Well, why do you think it is?
Well, I think it was a political, an attempt to make political hay out of the death of a handful of very brave diplomats, beginning and end.
Matt, we're almost up on a break, but how do you see it? And that's probably not a fair thing to do because we're almost up on a break, but go ahead. Short answer.
Well, look, there are a lot of questions do remain, and we do continue to see things come out. Like, for example, there was a FOIA request recently that revealed this Ben Rhodes email. We would have not known about it had it not been for a FOIA request that forced the administration to make it public, and it seems to imply that the administration was downplaying the notion that it was a pre-planned terrorist attack and trying to sort of get out the idea that it was a spontaneous thing that was because of a YouTube video. So I don't know if anything is going to come out that will help us to guard our consulates and better in the future. That would be the best thing that would come out. But at the very least, there could be some real political cover-up scandal that we just don't know about yet.
And that's Matt Lewis, a senior contributor to The Daily Caller and a contributing editor for The Week. Also with us, Paul Gastrus, editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly, was a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton. And Peter Beiner, associate professor of journalism and political science at the City University of New York, a contributor to The Atlantic and National Journal, and a Schwartz senior fellow at the New America Foundation. I do want to talk about, believe it or not, yes, we will, the upcoming race for the White House, and I want to pick our guest brains on that. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Opera Philadelphia presents the East Coast premiere of A Coffin in Egypt, a new opera by Ricky Ian Gordon, starring mezzo-soprano Frederica von Stade as a grand dame whose life in Egypt, Texas, has been filled with more tragedy than triumph. She has outlived everyone who matters, but at the last stage of her life, she cannot outlive the truth. A Coffin in Egypt, at the Perlman Theater from June 6th through 15th. Tickets and information at operaphila.org or 215-893-1018.
For the record, Annie, you flirted with me. You made me feel like you really liked me, which was really unfair.
That's Chris O'Dowd as a police officer in Bridesmaids, the film that made him famous in America. He's now on Broadway, starring with James Franco in Of Mice and Men, and his autobiographical TV series is on Hulu. Chris O'Dowd on the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
How the Snowden deal went down, along with the U.S. Constitution.
The documents reveal an NSA that say radically different things in private, that there should be no place where you can go and communicate free of the NSA's intrusive eye.
Glenn Greenwald on the public trust, why Edward Snowden came to him, and why we can never go back to our old assumptions about privacy. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I've been talking with Paul Gastrus, Matt Lewis, and Peter Beinart about President Obama's leadership overseas. A bit of a jarring switch in our conversation now. We do want to talk a bit about some of the potential candidates vying to succeed him in 2016. And if you want to join that part of the conversation, phone number 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at whyyradiotimes. Paul Gastrus, since you were a speechwriter for President Bill Clinton, is Hillary Clinton going to run for president?
I have no more information than the next person. I can't imagine she won't. All the stars seem aligned. I don't think in my lifetime we've had a presidential contest in which there was so much consensus within a party about who the standard bearer should be, who the nominee should be. I don't think Hillary, even though people talked about her campaign as being inevitable, and et cetera, in 2008, and it turned out not to be, despite that, much of it in 2008, I think there's more of it now, and more Democrats are more comfortable with her as the nominee than ever. So there will be a candidates who throw their hat in the ring. In my opinion, I think Martin O'Malley will probably run. Looks like Brian Schweitzer, the governor of Montana, will probably run. But it you know, you just have to sort of be kind of amazed at the degree to which she's pulled different members of the party leadership and the rank and file together behind her as yet unannounced candidacy.
But Peter, do you think there are risks for sort of having an easy walk to a nomination, that there are things that a candidate learns when they have to defend their opinions against their opponents?
Perhaps, but I think Hillary Clinton or any other candidate would be happier with an easier focus on an easier primary where you don't have to get pushed by party activists to take positions that might be less popular in a general election. You don't have to spend a lot of money. I think, you know, if you look at the harder, tougher, more divisive primaries like the one that Mitt Romney fought, I think they are harmful in the general election. I disagree a little with Paul. I think that actually the right candidate, I think Elizabeth Warren, for instance, I think would be a very formidable competitor to Hillary Clinton, and I actually think might well beat Hillary, could potentially beat Hillary Clinton. But I think that there would have to be someone with an Obama-like ability to tremendously excite the Democratic base, raise vast amounts of money on the internet, and create a kind of a movement candidacy around an issue of very powerful zeitgeist. And right now, and absent that, I think the institutional strength and the general strong goodwill that exists in the Democratic Party towards Hillary Clinton make it seem like an easy race.
Peter, you had a piece, though, about the idea of Joe Biden tossing his hat in the ring, and that would be a good thing because we could have a pretty vigorous foreign policy debate, maybe sort of like we were having earlier in this hour.
Right. I don't think Biden would have a chance of beating Hillary, but what I do think is interesting about Biden and Hillary is that if you look at what we know about the internal debates inside the Obama administration, they have very different perspectives on foreign policy. I think Hillary Clinton is significantly more hawkish than Barack Obama, less cautious about the use of American military intervention. And Joe Biden has been on the other side. He was on the other side of Hillary Clinton on the Afghan surge, on Libya, on Syria. And I think that debate would be very useful to have inside the Democratic Party because I think there are different wings of the party in terms of the questions of how much America should go out on a limb in terms of humanitarian intervention, and just generally the question of how large the footprint of American power needs to be. And it would be nice, I think, to see those raised in a Democratic primary.
Matt Lewis, I'm looking at some of the Republicans that are toying with the idea of running for president. Would it be fair to say that the GOP does not want to relive 2012, where there were, I don't know, 10 candidates and, 25 debates? I'm not, kind of lost count after a while, but sort of the feeling that that probably wasn't a good thing for the party itself?
Absolutely, and in fact, the Republican Party is taking steps to avoid that, trying to limit the number of debates. Nothing they can do about the number of candidates and the fact that there's no clear front runner, but they're trying to minimize the problems. I mean, look, as a sort of free market Hayekian, I used to also believe that vigorous primaries, that the cream would rise to the top and you could fight it out and the best ideas would emerge. But I'm with Peter now. I think at least for a cycle or two, the Republican Party would probably be better served to hash out their differences pretty quickly and settle on a nominee. I don't know that that's going to happen, though, right now. There really is no presumptive nominee.
How do you see Jeb Bush?
I think Jeb Bush has a lot of problems. There's the dynasty problem, of course. There's the fact that he's on the wrong side of some issues like Common Core and immigration reform, at least on the wrong side of the conservative base. And there's the fact that he hasn't really been in elected office for a long time now, and he hasn't stood for election for a long time. How's the fire in the belly? How much does he want the job? Is he willing to fight hard and campaign hard? So I think I can go down the list of all the potential candidates, and I think there's an asterisk beside each name of a pretty big problem that each of them would have to overcome on the Republican side if they're going to be the nominee and maybe the president.
Paul, what do you make of the fact that Karl Rove is sort of raising questions about Hillary Clinton's health, questions about how much damage was done to her brain when she fell? And he's been saying this for the last couple of weeks, or intimating it, certainly.
When Karl Rove, before he was a well-known national figure, when he was still a direct mail consultant working for judicial candidates in Mississippi and places like that, he was famous for rumors, spreading rumors, and in one case spread rumors through the Republican operative community and that another judge who was on the other side of a race was homosexual and may have been a pedophile. This is Karl Rove's way. He did it very publicly in this case, and I don't know if this time it's going to work for him. I don't think Karl Rove himself will pay a price for it. He's very skilled at this kind of thing, but I don't think that the charge is one that's going to work. It provides examples for the Democratic base that of a kind of persecution of Hillary that will be useful in rallying the troops, I think.
Peter, people talk about a Bush dynasty, but if we're talking about the Clintons, that there's a possible Clinton dynasty. Do you think Bill Clinton is potential baggage for Hillary?
He's a difficult person to control. We know from the writing about the 2008 campaign that he was a challenge for the Hillary Clinton staffers because he would sometimes go off and say things that were off message for them. But overall, he's a strength because he's a very strong campaigner. He's very popular in the country as a whole. And while it's true that talking about the 1990s is not a forward-looking message and in and of itself would not be enough for Hillary Clinton to win the presidency, it is also true that when Americans think of Bill Clinton's presidency, they think of peace and prosperity, which is not something that we've had since then. And that is a powerful I think maybe the single most powerful part of her of her kind of argument for why she would be a good president right now, and I think, and he's very much a part of that.
Matt, you talked about Indiana Governor Mike Pence as a dark horse. You said more charismatic than Scott Walker, more conservative than Chris Christie. So someone to keep an eye on?
Yeah, I think so. Now, he recently got into a little bit of trouble with the right also, speaking of those asterisks that I was talking about for Medicare expansion in Indiana. But look, I think he checks all the boxes. I mean, this is a guy who is widely respected as a full-spectrum conservative. He can talk evangelical talk to the social conservatives. He's respected by the Club for Growth folks, the fiscal conservatives, national security folks like him. Now he's been a U.S. congressman, so he has experience in Washington, but he's also, if he were to run, he would be running from a governorship, which Republicans in modern times have sort of traditionally kind of liked. So I think that, you know, he tends to get overlooked because he's in Indiana, but I think that Mike Pence is a dark horse, and we shouldn't sleep on Mike Pence.
Well, let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, floating some names for a possible run for the White House. We have Andrew calling us from Pineville, Pennsylvania. Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Well, I thank you, and I think the Republicans with their nomination choices, I hear a lot about it through politics, are way off base. The Tea Party is just as kind of stagnant as the extreme liberals, but I would vote for Chris Christie personally because I think he is more of a moderate and can deal across the aisle, so to speak. The way he dealt with the unions in New Jersey I thought was brilliant. And as far as the Democratic side, personally, I don't feel Hillary Clinton did such a great job running the State Department, and I don't see how anyone would think that she'd do a better job running the country.
So there's no Democrat that interests you, Andrew?
Not really. I believe that our Constitution, the writers of our Constitution had a great idea by changing things every 8 years, and I don't think I could take another 8 years of this. We're going to hold people accountable and nobody ever gets held accountable and giving things away. I believe it's time to start to stop giving things away and start running the country and the foreign policy with a more Republican kind of Ronald Reagan style rather than sit back and do nothing and just take care of social programs.
Well, it's an interesting perspective you have. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Paul Gastrus, how do you see Chris Christie?
I thought Chris Christie, though he has considerable political skills and is interesting and energetic and captivating on the stump, was always a very difficult sell to a Republican base. So much of his kind of machine politics of the kind that one has to practice to be successful in New Jersey rubs the base of the Republican Party wrong, I would think. Add to that the numerous investigations, including at the federal prosecutorial level, of a number of aspects of his administration that will be ongoing as the primaries get going, and I just cannot imagine that he'll be the candidate. Mm-hmm.
Peter, you had mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and I've seen her interviewed, and she always says, no, I'm not running for president. You know, sometimes you don't know how to read that, but nonetheless, you see her as a, if she did decide to run, that she would give Hillary a run for her money?
Yeah, I think she would. I mean, I have no reason to believe she is going to run, but I think that what we learned, not only in the Obama campaign, but in the Dean campaign going back to 2004, is that if you can mobilize and create real excitement amongst liberals and core Democratic activists, in today's world, first of all, you can raise extraordinary sums of money that will allow you to compete financially. Remember, Dean raised far more money than all the Washington candidates that year. Obama raised more than Hillary Clinton. You can make yourself financially competitive. Second of all, especially in caucus states, that passion is very, very effective. And in presidential campaigns, oftentimes the candidates who tend to do really well are the candidates who tap into a particular mood at a particular moment in time. And I think certainly in the Democratic Party, the mood today on economic issues is more populist. There's more of a sense, although people respect the Clintons a lot, they believe that things were good in the 1990s, I think there are also a lot of people who believe that the circumstances facing the country are quite different now, that the power of Wall Street, corporate power, has grown quite dramatically since then, that almost all of the economic benefits that we've seen since the Clinton years have accrued to a small number of people at the top, and who feel that there needs to be a more forceful response to that new reality than the kind of new Democrat economic views that really came out of the 1970s and 80s. Now, Hillary Clinton may, I think herself, will probably move to try to occupy some of that space, but she can't give it the full-throated passion and eloquence that Elizabeth Warren can, which is why I think Elizabeth Warren would be a very, very serious competitor. I think the Clinton people know that, but as you said, so far there's no evidence right. that she actually wants to take on Hillary.
And Matt Lewis, the final question to you, just looking at the GOP, does the GOP have a Tea Party problem, or are they part of their activist membership?
So I'm optimistic. I mean, I think that I'm one of the folks who believes that the Tea Party is now losing elections because they've kind of won in the sense that, you know, look, there were some old crony Republican politicians who had been around too long and they needed to be challenged. And some of them were defeated in primaries and some of them have gotten with the program. And so I think that what we've seen is sort of a pendulum. I think it swung a little bit too far in the Tea Party. Well, it was too far in the sort of Republican establishment, cozy, extreme, and then it swung maybe a little bit too far in the Tea Party extreme. And I think now you're seeing a balance. If you look at someone, a great example would be Ben Sasse, this young candidate who just won in Nebraska. It looks like he'll be a U.S. senator from Nebraska if all goes well, who is really smart and articulate. And I think he's really widely accepted by the Tea Party folks and the conservatives, but also the establishment. And I think that's a trend.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could go on. My thanks to all three of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Matt Lewis, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And he's a senior contributor to The Daily Caller, a contributing editor for The Week. Paul Gastrus, thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
And he's editor-in-chief of The Washington Monthly. And finally, Peter Beinart, thank you very much for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
He's a contributor, I should say, to The Atlantic and to The National Journal. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out about podcasts of the show, Twitter, Facebook, email, and satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.